This is season 2, episode 17 of the Doctors and Litigation, the L Word podcast. I'm Dita Pensa. Welcome back, everybody. Okay, it is June 2025, and this is going to be the last episode of season 2. Fear not, I will be taking just a quick break and I'll be back at the end of the summer for season 3. And then it will also be time to sign up for the second Leap for Clinicians course. So for those of you who missed it, I've created a course called Leap, or Litigation Education and Performance, the Leap course for clinicians. It's a package of what I believe you need to know about the practical aspects of litigation and legal performance, and a lot on the coaching principles I use with my one-on-one clients. This is a 12-week video course. You get self-paced video content every week, and then some additional live Q&A webinars, including an Ask a Lawyer session. And this last time we had a mock deposition session, and you'll get CME credits as well. And I'm so excited because the feedback from our inaugural cohort was really great, and I think people learned a lot. And so if you're interested in being in the next cohort, which will start in September, stay tuned. I will be back at the end of the summer with both a new season of this podcast and information for how you can sign up. All right, now on to the main dish. This month I have something different. I have for you an interview with a plaintiff's attorney. Now, so far in all these many years, I have not invited a plaintiff's attorney on to this podcast. But I have to say that Chad Engelhardt is not your average plaintiff's attorney. So before you listen to this episode, I'd like you to listen to the interview with Rick Boothman about the Michigan model, which is episode 13. Now, Rick Boothman trained as a defense attorney. Chad Engelhardt, whom you'll hear from in just a moment, is a plaintiff's attorney who is also a staunch advocate of Boothman's Michigan model. And we're here to talk about that again, because I feel this is very important, and I feel that we all deserve a better system than what we've got, and that programs like Michigan's show us a way forward. You'll hear more about his story in the interview, but let me give you his bio. Chad Engelhardt is a patient safety advocate and a dedicated believer in the holistic effectiveness of healthcare CRP programs. He seeks to help patients and providers learn from and prevent adverse medical events while rebuilding trust between patients and the healthcare system after an adverse event. Before becoming a lawyer, he served for over 12 years as an officer with a large law enforcement agency, and he is the past chairperson of the Negligence Law Section of the State Bar of Michigan, and he's a member of the Executive Committee for the Institute of Continuing Legal Education. He's a fellow of the Michigan State Bar Foundation, and in recognition of his trial skills, his civility, and professionalism, Mr. Engelhardt was honored with the prestigious Respected Advocate Award by the Michigan Defense Trial Council in 2023. He's a Harvard Law School trained mediator. He serves as a facilitator and a case evaluator. And in addition to his legal practice, he's an adjunct professor and clinical field supervisor at Cooley Law School, where he mentors students and teaches courses in medical malpractice and litigation skills. He's been a repeat guest lecturer for the University of Michigan's Law School trial practice courses, an author, editor, scholar, and actually a really nice guy. So I offer you this conversation with a plaintiff's attorney whom now I consider to be a friend, and that will give you some food for thought, I hope. Chad, thanks for coming into the lion's den, to the podcast, to talk about your work as a plaintiff's attorney.
Well, thank you, Gita, and I don't view it as a lion's den. I have nothing but respect for our healthcare providers and the important work that you do.
Well, I do appreciate that. Why don't you, for the listeners, introduce yourself and talk about the work that you do?
My name's Chad Engelhardt, and I am a plaintiff's attorney part of the time. I'm both a law professor and a lawyer. However, most of my work involves trying to work collaboratively through CRP processes that I'm sure we'll talk about, to try to resolve claims. And most of our work is injury that occurs in the healthcare setting. So that's the frame of that. Our practice is a little different than most traditional plaintiff litigation firms, though.
Yeah. And so we're going to zoom in on that for a second. It's not often or even ever that I have plaintiff's attorneys on the show. But you and I had a pretty great conversation a while back, and that made me feel like this would be actually a really, not just okay, but instructive thing for us to do and to have you on talking about your thoughts about plaintiff's attorney work in general. And then we're going to talk more about CRP programs as well. Firstly, I'll say that I don't see you as a typical, quote unquote, plaintiff's attorney, or at least a stereotypical one that would be in the minds of many doctors. So part of that may have to do with some of your background. Tell us how you became a plaintiff's attorney and what your career was before that.
Sure. So let me start out by saying one of the ways that our firm is different is that we do have a mission, and that is we see ourselves as being here to help reduce suffering, to do good in the world. And we do that by giving a voice to people who have been hurt or have lost a loved one, and by helping them to find answers and also to help them rebuild trust with the healthcare system. My route to this work is a little unusual, and that probably informs why our mission is what it is. I started my adult career, adulting, in law enforcement, and I worked for 12 years for a big police agency, and I worked my way through undergrad and law school. My father was an emergency medicine physician, one of the stakeholders, one of the original ASAP founders. My mother was a psychologist, and they instilled in me the need to help and serve others. And my wife is my partner here at the office and in life in academia, has spent most of her career as a lawyer representing doctors and a big hospital, a big health system that she worked for. We try to take a rather holistic approach to these matters.
That might be the mission, I feel like, that other plaintiff's attorneys may say that they cleave to. But I actually, after our conversations, we spent a lot of time on the phone, feel that you actually cleave to that mission, which is, I think, really important for physicians to hear that there are plaintiff's attorneys out there who are really interested in the human side of things rather than just the pursuit of dollar signs. And we can get into that more in a little bit. But, you know, you're talking to a lot of physicians and other clinicians who have legitimate disdain for and fear of the civil litigation process. Most physicians have, you know, a lot of ire for plaintiff's attorneys because we do often get sued for things over which we had no control or when there was no negligence or error. And oftentimes doing what seemed reasonable at the time in hindsight can be and is made to look monstrous. And none of us went into this to be monsters or to be seen as monsters. So what can you say, given your experience, to speak to that feeling that we have?
Sure. Well, first of all, certainly very few of the claims that we handle involve monsters. That does occasionally happen, but for the most part, doctors are human, and humans can make mistakes, and human error can lead to patient injury. And there's also a lot of systemic driving factors that culminate in unfortunate adverse events, including patient injury. And sometimes, because the doctor is the captain of the ship or in charge of a team of healthcare providers, that's where the target falls. On the other hand, one of the things that you mentioned, there's a lot to unpack from your question.
That's true.
The notion that in our system of justice, sometimes justice is measured in dollars and cents, and there are lawyers, unquestionably, that see their mission as one of vengeance or one of gathering the most money at any cost to the system, to their clients, to themselves, or to the doctors. And they don't take into account the insult, danger, risks of litigation itself and the impact that that may have on their clients. My personal ethic is different. There are many lawyers that have the same belief system that I do, that what we're looking for is the least invasive approach, the minimal effective dose, if you will, that helps to the system, because ideally any resolution helps the system address whatever the underlying factors are that contributed to the patient injury, coupled with some measure of reasonable compensation for the family and some answers to why this occurred. Because invariably, and we screen thousands of calls a year in order to come up with a small caseload that we have, we are very careful in our case screening, and we involve physicians and other experts to help us, and that toxicologist, pharmacologist, to help us screen our cases and make sure we're bringing meritorious cases. In fact, you asked me about what led me to be a malpractice attorney. That was a case of a monster. And that was, I had left law enforcement and I was doing police misconduct defense, defending police officers that were accused of excessive force or misconduct. And my partner, Steve, who's been my mentor now for almost two decades, was litigating a case of multiple patients who were subjected to sexual abuse by a doctor inside a hospital, a residential brain injury facility.
Oh my goodness.
And he had been brought on board to help these women in a number of ways. And he brought me on board because I had been trained in my law enforcement days in the field of crisis intervention and including sexual assault intervention, basically dealing with patients in crisis. That doctor is in prison for the rest of his life. By the time these cases came to the civil setting, the doctor had already been convicted. So this was about the compensation that was required. It could never make them whole, but to provide them with the resources to somewhat compensate them for the trauma that they had undergone, and also to obtain treatment and quality of life improvements despite what had happened to them. And so there are monsters in the healthcare scene. Thankfully, those are far and few between. And then after those cases were successfully resolved, we returned to our firm's litigation practice of medical malpractice. And soon after that is when Rick Boothman at the University of Michigan developed the Michigan model and advocated for that. And we were early adopters and collaborators in that approach with him. And so that took a major change in career for my wife and I and our firm, in that we try to take the approach, and I know you've probably talked about CRP programs before.
Well, we just had Rick Boothman on the podcast a little while ago. And so, yeah, so this is actually a really nice part two.
Well, you know what's funny? I left Rick a voicemail message this morning thanking him for the mentorship that he has given me and the guiding light that he has given me, because he truly changed my philosophy, my paradigm, my worldview on both the intersection between medicine and law and how these claims should be handled. Because I think that listening to your podcast, the episodes that I have, and in speaking with you, we both recognize, and your audience recognizes, that we have a dysfunctional system. That number one, the empirical evidence tells us that there are problems with our healthcare system. But more importantly, from our perspective, there's a dysfunction where healthcare, the medical system, meets the legal system. Mm-hmm. And we have a system of justice that is inherently adversarial, expensive, where the pursuit of truth is not always found, and where there are evidentiary rules and other factors that limit recoveries, limit access to evidence, limit access to finding out what can be done to encourage safer, higher quality care. And instead, the traditional model of delay, deny, defend only encourages covering up or denying that problems occur. And that doesn't help anybody.
I want to go back to talking about Rick for a second.
Sure.
So tell me the story about how your interaction with Rick and the Michigan model. You're a bit younger than Rick. I don't know how far you were in your practice before this sort of transformation in your way of thinking about it came to light. But can you tell us a little bit of the story about that transition?
You know, the first case is one that involved traditional litigation. And when he was first in starting the program, there's a case that stands out to me with Rick, because it's the case where he changed my mind. I really can't talk to you about the nature of the case on the podcast because of the patient sensitivity nature, but there was an adverse event and a patient was seriously hurt. And in Michigan, they had just at the time started a process where the claims against the university had to be preserved by filing a special governmental notice because the university is a state hospital, that a certain special type of notice had to be filed in order to preserve the claims later, if you so choose. And I filed the claim based on very limited evidence because we didn't have the evidence, even though the records had been requested, but also only from the patient's perspective. And we served it on, at that time, there was a requirement that the potential parties be served. And so the doctors got these notices in the mail. And I got a call from Rick Boothman. And of course, you know, Rick calls, you answer. So, so I answer the phone and Rick, the first words out of his mouth were, "Chad, what the F is the matter with you?" And he tore me a new one because there were things that I hadn't accounted for.
Okay.
And he let me know that what I had submitted, and I look back and he was 100% correct, was filled with the kind of legal language that is harmful and vitriolic about negligence, neglect, professional malpractice, you know, wanton and willful disregard of the patient's rights. So these legal terms that are bandied about by lawyers at the drop of a hat to describe legal claims and how harmful that was to the doctor. And I will tell you that in the aftermath, and this is kind of the follow-up to that story, this was an initial CRP program. We went through it. Things worked out fine. But two things stand out to me. One was that the patient, during the process, had a question. This doctor that we've now filed this claim against, he said that she had the sense that he was a caring, kind doctor who had her best interest at heart. She had the underlying condition that she had that needed to be corrected. And she wanted to maintain treatment with him. And could she do that? And of course, she hadn't been discharged. So I did call and Rick and I had a very good conversation. And he talked to the doctor and he agreed. He wanted to maintain his professional relationship and continuity of care with this complex patient and work her through that. We did have meetings with the doctor and the patient and the team afterward to do a root cause analysis. This involved a subspecialist in a complex area of medicine, right? Someone who had been through, you know, both fellowship and further fellowship training in a subspecialty of medicine in a very complex area with very few providers. Fast forward many years, and my father, who had then retired from medicine after an unfortunate event, a stroke, needed that specialist in his care team, that area of medicine. And after watching that doctor, who I had unfortunately cast as a monster, and he wasn't. There was an adverse event, no question, and it was dealt with. But I saw how that doctor treated our client, our shared patient, in the aftermath. And I saw his work up, and I watched his work in real time as things were going on. And when my father needed a doctor in that specialty, I asked that he be assigned to that case. It was because of how he dealt with things in the aftermath. And honestly, at one point, I had to ask for his forgiveness because Rick had told me how upset he was by, you know, the legal notice that I had sent and the legal language in it that was harmful to him, traumatic for him. Because the event, and one of the things that I'm kind of focused in my career on right now, is recognizing the trauma that occurs to witnesses, to providers, and family members, that the trauma that occurs from an adverse event isn't just limited to the patient. And that really we have an obligation to try to handle claims in a civil and professional manner that doesn't aggravate trauma, it doesn't worsen trauma for anybody. And so Rick really helped guide me through that process and helped me develop that mindset.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about that story, which is a very meaningful and important story, I think. The physician that you're talking about, as part of the CRP process, you know, you sent this really strongly worded legal notice, and then you entered into the CRP tight program and then there were discussions, was the physician able to talk to the patient about the harm event that happened? Were they able to come through well in this relationship so that they could continue treatment well together? That's what happened?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, what happened is that the case came to us just before the notice requirement deadline. So it's a 6-month notice requirement.
Oh,
so the case
see.
Came to us. Yeah. So there wasn't time for us to engage in the process, which takes several months. We had to preserve the claim up front.
Yes. So that's what some people may not understand about CRPs, is that usually people are preserving their right to file a traditional lawsuit. You don't give that up usually to enter into this communication process with the healthcare team. But to preserve that right, you did have to file things before the statute of limitations were up.
Exactly. And that's still the case in many of our cases, where we have to file these legal notices with the Court of Claims, which is the special court where claims against the state are filed, to preserve those rights, and then engage in the process going forward. There is some advantage institutionally from doing that. At least it gives the institution, if there was something that was correctable, it gives the institution notice of it so that it can correct a deficiency or a problem. That's the purpose that the state requires us to file these 6-month notices, is that if there's something correctable, it doesn't just apply to the healthcare setting. Imagine it applies to, you know, like a public building. If there's a defect in a public building that's endangering the public, the state needs to know so it can fix the defect.
Mm-hmm.
There's a problem with some state machine. They need to know that. And so that's why that 6-month notice exists. It's so that it allows the state time to quickly fix and remedy a problem before it endangers other members of the public, and also to preserve evidence. That's the reason for that notice.
So what you got to see almost in real time were these two different processes working at the same time. You got to serve this physician, this really well-intentioned, highly skilled physician, with these papers that had this really damaging language that we have talked about on this podcast before in the episode about getting served and service of process and what that can feel like. And then, I guess Rick reached out, but then you also got to see the CRP process play out in a way that I imagine was much more restorative and cooperative.
It was absolutely restorative for both the patient and the provider. And it turned out that the physician, other than being the captain of the ship responsible, the adverse event, which was significant and severe, was caused by those that were working in the care team underneath his attending supervision. It turned out that his liability was vicarious, basically like the captain of the ship, not his personal hands-on actions. And there were also some systemic factors that were policy issues that had to be addressed. But it turns out that this doctor certainly was not, you know, neglectful, was not acting in disregard to this patient's rights, those things. And it hurt him to hear that about his involvement with the patient, because, like, I will bet the vast majority of your listeners, that physician had a very deeply rooted identity in his being a physician and the work that he did. And my own father, Dr. Stan, the medicine man, that was his identity. And so having that attacked was traumatic for him. I thank Rick for calling me out on it. Quote, thank you for calling me out on my bullshit. And so I do appreciate that that occurred. It also helped me over time to understand the nature of how we do our work is not just based on the outcome. It's how we get there. And it's how we get there for our patients, our shared patients, and also for each other, for the healthcare system, for the providers, and selfishly, even for our legal team.
Let's talk about that for a second. I am on board with everything you're saying. I still think that you're a bit of what we call in medicine a zebra. How do your plaintiff's attorney colleagues feel about the CRP approach, especially in this age of nuclear verdicts, and there's sort of this turning tide, and maybe you can try a case in New Mexico and get a $500 million verdict? That's not happening in a CRP.
Oh, absolutely not. The recoveries are typically far lower than you would see in litigation, but they are obtained in a way that is not destructive. That holistically, the results are, in my mind, when you look at the qualitative factors, far superior, because even though the monetary amount may not be as high potentially, it's incurred sooner. The CRP program effectively handles the issues that make litigation so troublesome. Number one, litigation is not restorative. CRP programs are, they help to rebuild trust. And I'll tell you a story about that that involves Rick. The second thing is that the expenses are significantly less. And as a consequence, the risk, the exposures, typically we are able to reduce our fees significantly, even though the gross recovery is left, we're able to reduce our fees such that the net recovery to the patient can be significantly enhanced.
Okay.
That is a true anomaly among the legal profession. I don't know of anyone that does that. But there's also times where, frankly, we have just this year, there was an important case that involved a child. And it actually happened in an outside institution. And then the university assisted this child and provided exceptional care in the aftermath. And our firm took the case. This is an institution that didn't have a CRP program. And we introduced them to the concept and we worked through this. And at the end of the day, our firm, instead of accepting the fee, we gave half the fee to the child's sister, which wouldn't normally happen because the sister was helping to raise her. And then the other half, we were able to donate to a C.S. Mott Children's Hospital at the university in recognition for what they did. We would never be able to do that in a litigated case, but we were able to do that through the CRP program because we hadn't incurred hundreds of thousands of dollars in costs. You know, the university helped with the cost sharing. The time and risk was less, and we were able to make a true altruistic good come out of that for many people.
Well, that's a tremendous story. So to get back to the question I had about your plaintiff's attorney colleagues.
So I have to have a really good exposure to kind of the attitudes and beliefs of a number of practitioners, because I do sit on, and I've been the chairperson of a section of the state bar that represents, if you will, both plaintiff and defense attorneys. I teach at a law school.
Yep.
And I do a lot of continuing legal education teaching. That's about half of what we do is academic. So half my work is academic or philanthropic, and half of it is private practice and of that. I do get some exposure to that. And I will tell you that, ironically, the pushback on the adoption of CRP programs, which, by the way, is I am an advocate for them. Every case that we get in, if a system doesn't have a CRP program, we try to introduce that and give them resources like the AHRQ toolkit, like Collaboration for Accountability, Tom Gallagher's program at the University of Washington. I send the hospitals these toolkits and ask them to meet with us and try to get them involved in these programs. The pushback we get is not philosophically for most plaintiff lawyers on this topic. It's actually distrust of healthcare systems, distrust of providers, and by far distrust of the insurance defense attorneys who bill by the hour. The acceptability of this process to many plaintiff's attorneys that understand it, I think they're far more accepting of it. There are some outliers, and what you mentioned is exactly right. There are some people who are motivated to take every case they can to trial in order to try to obtain a significant multi-million dollar recovery. And in some cases, that's absolutely justified. But on the other hand, we believe that litigation itself and the risk and exposure of trial for both the plaintiff, the provider, the institution, and all involved should all be tools of last resort. Unfortunately, there are people on both sides of the coin in our profession, both plaintiff lawyers and defense lawyers, that believe that civil justice happens in the courtroom and that that is the place for these claims to be decided. And there is a place for that, but it should, in our view, be the last resort, not the first resort.
Do you think that now with the era of litigation funding, third-party funding of litigation, do you think that that will disincentivize plaintiff's attorneys to go along with CRP programs. Now, we haven't covered litigation funding on the podcast yet. I feel like I should do a whole episode on it. So people might not be aware that third-party investors in plaintiff attorneys' cases is becoming much more of a phenomenon now. And it really does sort of propel a lot of these cases towards trial and towards these sort of spectacular verdicts. But what do you feel about that system being a bar to the more wide adoption of CRP cultures?
So, as with many things, I do have a strong opinion in this area.
Okay. You're here for your opinion.
I've taken positions to advocate on this issue in professional areas. Because you haven't introduced this topic to your audience, let's talk about what third-party funding is. And that is, there's different ways that that occurs. The first is the traditional funding sources. Medical malpractice cases are exceptionally expensive in our civil justice to pursue, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Typically are the expense costs on each side. Mm-hmm. Plaintiff lawyers don't get that from their client. They advance that, and different firms handle that differently. Many firms have a line of credit through a bank or through a financial institution that is a way to fund cases. And the firm, the law firm, the lawyers have that risk that if something goes south, they're going to have to pay back this loan because their client who is catastrophically injured certainly is not going to pay back that loan, regardless of who's the legal responsibility. The loan is taken out in the lawyer's name and they have to pay for that. And that's traditional, kind of a line of credit business funding or from the lawyer's own assets. Third-party litigation funding, though, is different in two ways. Number one is there are non-recourse loans where the third party, in exchange for some what I consider to be usurious fee, loans the lawyer or the client, and through the client, the lawyer, the money to litigate the case. That is these expert witness fees on a non-recourse basis, meaning that if the case goes to trial and the case is found in favor of the defense, there's no recourse. They don't get paid back. There are other third-party funding where the client, the injured person, essentially sells their cause of action, the right to recovery, to a third party because they need something. They need medical care. They're going to be evicted from their home, lose their car. They have children that need to go to school and eat. They accept money from a third party and they essentially sell a portion of their lawsuit and future recovery to a third-party lender, if you will, at an extreme rate. Mm-hmm. And finally, there are also some effective ways to mitigate risk, because that's what we're talking about, is mitigating the risk of and cost of litigation. And that is through various products of insurance. That is not third-party funding. That's mitigating risk through insurance. We'll leave that probably for a separate comment. I'm opposed to allowing anyone else but the client to have control over their cases. Because in the contracts for those third-party lending companies, typically it assigns not just the portion of the lawsuit, which might be all or 99% or some large percentage, the right to make dispositive decisions about the case may be reserved to the lender, to the litigation company, not to the patient. And there's legal fictions that are used to allow this. I am almost categorically opposed to this kind of work. There's litigation funding that's in terms of like loans that may be appropriate. But when you look at how these are handled, they do encourage there's the notion that they de-escalate the risk level for both the patient and their lawyer, and thus encourage the risks of litigation and to roll the dice at trial. And in fact, may force the case to trial.
Right.
And those are contrary to our purposes, which are, number one, providing the patient and rebuilding their trust with the healthcare system and giving them agency and giving them control. Part of the CRP process and the resolution, which oftentimes does involve a third-party mediator. And my wife and I both in that capacity when requested too, as a third-party intermediary between the parties. That helps to rebuild and restore trust, but does so in a way where the injured patient or their family, if they were killed, or a child is exercising some degree of agency and self-determination.
Yeah.
And that's so important in the process when the injury occurred. There was often the feeling of helplessness, that there was nothing they could do, and sometimes the guilt and trauma that comes with that. And we're trying to repair that. And in a CRP program, you know who else is? The hospital.
Right.
We're all working together to repair that.
Right. I do worry about that trend, you know, because I obviously am a fan of CRPs. Now, this is my second episode that we're talking about this, and the World of Hurt documentary focused a lot on that. And anything that moves us towards a more humane process and a more restorative process is something that I am interested in. And I do look at that and I see that as a threat. Do they have a stance, the plaintiffs bar in general? Do they have a stance on it? Do they have a stance on CRPs? You, as I keep saying, are sort of an anomaly, although I want everyone to listen to you. But what's the national feeling on this?
So let me back up and just like the legal caveat of I don't speak for the plaintiffs bar. I can barely speak for myself. So when you say the plaintiffs bar, it is a heterogeneous group, right? So We have people like me that have beliefs in one area, and I'm on one end of a spectrum.
Yeah.
My wife and I and our firm, our partners, we are solidly in one end of a spectrum. There's a complete opposite end of the spectrum. And all you have to do is drive down the expressway or turn on the TV and watch the commercials, and you see where the opposite end of that spectrum is. And there's legitimacy and a need for both, maybe. I happen to believe that our philosophy and our methodology and the way that we do things is truly a win-win. In fact, one of the books I wanted to recommend, I just finished reading it last night.
Okay.
Is a book by Rebecca Sposita. It's called Win-Win, Helping Organizations Mitigate Legal Risk for the Common Good, What Every Executive, Risk Manager, and HR Director Needs to Know.
Okay, I will link to it.
What I love about this, number one, Rick Boothman was interviewed for it. And this is actually going to be recommended reading in my medical malpractice law school course because of its discussion of CRP programs. But the book itself talks about something that's at the core of what our firm philosophy is and what we believe the ethic of the plaintiff's bar and the defense bar, the bar as a whole, should be. And that is, if the first rule of medicine is to do no harm, the second rule of medicine and the first rule of law should be do no further harm.
Ah, I like that.
So Rebecca Sposita, the author, actually reached out to me. We're doing a program. I'm the education chair for the state bar in our area of practice called negligence law. I actually don't like the term negligence because I now believe it has some connotation of punitive. Even the term negligence is the wrong term, right? I like to use adverse event, perhaps iatrogenic injury, medication event, medical error. I try to make it a little more clinical. Unfortunately, the law is not in that area. Anyways, I'm doing a program with two professors from the university's Department of Psychiatry, one of who is a psychiatrist, the other is someone who's involved in forensic medicine, about post-traumatic stress disorder and how to minimize stress for victims of trauma, which includes sexual abuse. And then we also have a hospital risk manager that's joining us. In fact, a risk manager that I work with, not at the University of Michigan, but at an outside facility, who has specialty in this area. So we're talking about how to investigate when necessary, litigate, but hopefully to work through the legal minefield, recognizing that our actions as lawyers can cause further harm and can be harmful to people who've already suffered harm and others. And so we have this program. So the author reached out to me, and it's someone who I certainly knew of in the past. This book goes through a number of settings, healthcare, human resources. It's largely healthcare driven. But if you think about it, there are conflicts that occur between human resource issues and harassment issues and other things that occur in the healthcare setting because your healthcare settings and doctors are large employers in most states.
Yeah.
So it helps to deal with those situations. And the premise of the book is if you deal with things in a way that recognizes the potential for further harm, basically a trauma-informed care approach, you will reduce the temperature in the room and potentially avoid litigation, avoid claims, and improve relationships and trust. And the empirical data from the university, Rick Boothman's data on this, is dead solid, right? It's been repeated and repeated and repeated.
It is. Mm-hmm.
And while there is some variation over time and institution and degrees of implementation, when we looked at this and basically amalgamated the data, what we were looking at academically was that when an institution properly implements a CRP program, they see an 80% reduction in claims being filed and a far more significant savings in cost. But as Rick Boothman will be the first, and I'm sure was the first to point out, it's not about the claims and the cost savings. It's about the human impact.
100%. And the ability for institutions to actually learn from their mistakes when mistakes are made.
That has to be the number one goal. And when we start a CRP program, I should mention, some people think, and I think part of the reason why those lawyers that refuse to participate in the process are hesitant to do so is that there are many cases that we work through a CRP process with hospitals because of our location and relationship at largely the University of Michigan. You know, leaders in the best, go blue, top notch, the innovators of the Michigan model. Both my wife and I are lifetime alumni members.
Nice.
Many of the cases have non-traditional or components of non-traditional means of compensation. That is compensation that's not dollars and cents, but rather quality improvement and patient safety oriented results. And an example would be, we have several cases where patients have filmed, in fact, one going on right now, filming patient safety and patient impact videos that are used in house officer and nursing training programs. We had one program where, rather than economic compensation to the family, the university purchased a number of automatic defibrillators, AEDs, to distribute to local public service agencies. We've had cases where part of the process was quality improvement in the sense that they purchased magnets for pacemakers, and not just having them at the cardiovascular center, but having them in all the emergency rooms and all the urgent cares as well. Because if a patient comes in with a misfiring pacemaker that needs to be shut off,
they ought to have a magnet. We have a magnet like taped, so we know where it is. It's like taped to the wall in one of the recess rooms. But yeah, they should have magnets.
Right. And so that's a nominal cost, right? And now, granted, the university is a large institution, many urgent cares, many ER bays, et cetera. They have a lot of magnets to buy. But that was a nominal cost, and they addressed a situation that way. I think probably when you talk about the positive nature of CRP programs, so it's not always economic. And sometimes there is an economic component. That's not the primary goal. It's a secondary goal that can be important. In those cases where the compensation is not dollars and cents, we don't charge the patient. If we commit to shepherding a client and representing and advocating for them and working collaboratively on a case, we're doing so for the purpose of improving quality of care in our community and at an institution which, quite frankly, I have a great deal of fondness and admiration for. We work collaboratively with their patient relations and clinical risk staff and lawyers to do that. I think that there are many lawyers who don't have a business model that would allow that. You know, they can't take those, what would be in legal terms considered pro bono cases. And we take a large number of them. And there are times where it presents, obviously, economic business issues. There's only so many we can take on.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Just like if you were running a private practice, there's only so many patients that you can see and not charge.
Of course.
To the extent that there's pushback or that there's some people we can't help, there is an economic viability and an economic component to CRP processes and the justice system, unfortunately. Let me tell you about one quick case that involves Rick.
Okay.
There was a patient who was living about 45 minutes from Ann Arbor in a more rural area and receiving their primary care and specialty care at their local facilities. The patient was referred for specialty care to the university, and there was an adverse event.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that same adverse event was part of a systemic problem.
Okay.
rather than sweep it under the rug and hope no one found out about it, which is unfortunately what 99.9% of institutions would do.
You know what? I hate to say it. I know the culture of which you speak, so continue.
There was a nurse in Rick Boothman's staff who was a wonderful lady, and she reached out to this patient, but also several other patients that were impacted, and explained what happened to them, asked them to come to the university and meet with the department chair and walk them through what happened, and then did individualized assessments of how can we mitigate the harm or risk and make sure there was medical monitoring put in place to address this adverse event. And we know that they also took the provider that was involved out of clinical circulation, if you will, and put him in strictly an administrative and research role for the rest of his term at the university.
Because there was a clear error on his part?
Yes. Unfortunately, he had begun administering certain medications, which are known to be nephrotoxic and other issues, without IRB approval. Patients using a drug off-label without informed consent, doing his own study, and didn't have IRB approval.
Oh, okay.
So you can see where the university found out, and now it's like, oh no, right?
Okay, that makes sense.
And unfortunately, one of the side effects of the medication is that it can cause infertility in women of childbearing years.
Oh my, okay.
So you can see where there's an issue, right?
I can see there's an issue, yeah.
But to the university's credit, what it did in that circumstance was not hide the problem, which is what, as you know, that would be the culture. That would be the traditional culture. Instead, the university reached out, brought all of these women back in, had them, you know, tested medical monitoring. And then we were brought in to handle the compensation end of things because the university wanted to offer them fair and full compensation. It also wanted to make sure things on the back end, things involving insurance subrogation issues and reimbursements and that sort of thing were handled to protect the patients. And this goes to show you why this is a superior system.
Mm-hmm.
That patient who lived 45 minutes away, who suffered a adverse event and harm that was clearly preventable, but disclosed, transparency, accountability, and a path forward, switched the entirety of their care, primary care, specialty care, their entire care to the university because of the honesty that they were dealt with.
Wow. So when you talk about restoring trust in the healthcare system, look at that.
Absolutely. And the flip side is, because of that, one of the things that Rick Boothman did that has a legacy was establishing the credibility of his program to the extent that there have been many, many cases where we felt there was a violation of standard of care, where we had expert support. But after going through the CRP program, the family and our firm decided not to pursue the case, that essentially we were shown things that we didn't consider or that made the case such that it was understandable. You could see where that happened reasonably. There was an adverse event. There was evidence that could be seen in one light to be violations of the standard of care or, quote, professionally negligent, but viewed in another light could be conceived of as reasonable. The case that Rick uses to illustrate this, Rick comes to my law school class every year, and I really thank him for that.
I want to sit in on that class.
You're welcome. Absolutely. I would love that.
To Michigan.
I would love that. So Rick uses one of our CRP cases. We represent a lot of healthcare providers, as you know, personally, just because being a healthcare provider offers no protective effect. Unfortunately, we saw there's a wonderful program at the local hospital about a physician who was the victim of poor care. So a number of our clients happen to be healthcare providers or families of healthcare providers.
Which makes sense, right? If you work at this institution, if you work at the University of Michigan Health System, if you work there and you get your care there and something unfortunate happens that you feel was preventable, then to enter into this adversarial conflict with your employer and your colleagues and everybody else there feels bad. It feels bad, but you still need
representation.
You still need representation.
The fact that someone's a healthcare provider, we have the notion of the cobbler's shoes. Sometimes other providers in providing you care may do so, if you're a healthcare provider, in a less emotionally qualified. You know, they may be more clinical than is would normally be with a lay patient, but also they may assume that you did things as a clinician for yourself or a family member that you wouldn't do. Just think of a case where it was a woman who fortunately suffered a cerebral herniation from overly rapid correction of hyponatremia. And essentially the providers were in the room. This was not at the university, by the way, outside. They looked at the husband about, well, when you saw X, why didn't you say something? That wasn't his role. And he carried a tremendous amount of guilt for that. You know, one of the things that when we look at evaluating cases, it happens that at the same time, you talked about A World of Hurt, wonderful documentary, and is all of the patients that were presented in that film were my clients and my wife's clients, right? Those were all our clients. At the same time that the first case was going on, the case of Megan Barrett, which is public, there's no confidentiality. And that case actually is the case study that we use as the primary case study in my law school class. That was a case of a woman who presented, a young woman with straight venous thrombosis in the sinus vein. There was a radiologic misdiagnosis and a clinical misdiagnosis in the emergency room, and the patient unfortunately dies. There's lots of that story, but at the same time, we were dealing with that same circumstance at a different institution, which I won't name, but which has an excellent CRP program.
Interesting.
Ironically, that case unfortunately involved the healthcare provider who was the patient. Both cases started at the same time. The case that went through a CRP program at the institution that I can't name resolved quickly and with restored trust. And the wife, who was also a physician at that hospital, maintained her employment, maintained her trust, understood how things happen, and was informed of what was going to be done to correct the problem in the future. In that case, they checked off MRA instead of MRV, or didn't do both, right? So they got an MRA study instead of an MRV study. So, you know, just one checkbox.
Which is so easy to do. Yeah. I mean, these EMR systems make their error inducing, their error promoting. There are studies that show that.
In any event, that case was resolved in a matter of months in a very restorative, respectful, non-adversarial way. And truly a tragedy. But long-term, the healing that took place in moving forward was evident. On the other hand, with the Barrett case, where it was delayed, denied, defend, all through the process, that resulted in Amanda Grisham, her sister, talks about this during the documentary. And she also comes to our law school class and talks about her experience and the incredible destructive nature of that lawsuit. Even though, regardless of what the financials were, whether one was a superior outcome financially, looking at the whole, the emotional trauma that the family went through the CRP program was spared and instead was provided with a positive reinforcement, validation, support. And guess who else didn't have to go through the adversarial trauma of litigation? Were all of the providers involved. They were spared that. They had their own traumas to deal with, having been involved in that situation. On the other hand, in the case that was litigated, you know, outside hospital, at the radiologist's deposition, who, by the way, is featured, actually you can hear parts of it in that documentary, he comes to his deposition and admits, yes, there was a clear miss. And he sat there for 2.5 years. And first of all, unqualified apology to the sister and the family that were present, explained that it was his fault. And this is the part that to this day just shocks me. Explains, I wanted to reach out to you and apologize and express my condolences. And I wanted to let you know what happened. And the hospital wouldn't let me. And I've been living with this for years. I've wanted to quit being a doctor. I've wanted to quit practice. And this haunts me. I can't sleep at night some nights because of this. And I want to tell you this because I want to beg you for your forgiveness. Now, mind you, at the outset of this case, we reached out to the hospital and asked them. They don't have a CRP program. We asked them to meet. We asked to go through this process. And instead, they put their doctor through this. And even after that, continued the litigation.
None of this is a surprise to me. None of it is a surprise. But I mean, listening to that contrast of those two cases running in parallel, I think just really does show it. So I could talk to you all day about these things, but I want to just shift gears for one second and ask you, I know that you also teach at medical school.
So we do guest lectures at medical schools across the country. In fact, at Brown, where you were, we were at Albert Medical School. We do patient safety programs. Our programs are tailored. We do nursing and medical school programs that are tailored to the individual programs that we're in. For example, oftentimes we're called in to teach to emergency medicine residents, or sometimes it's multidisciplinary, sometimes it's more of a grand rounds. And it is basically two programs, sometimes combined. The first is literally called the Anatomy of a Lawsuit, kind of a common name for that kind of program.
I always joke about that.
It is important because, and my wife Jennifer used to do this. This was part of her job when she was the lawyer for the hospital, where what we fear is the unknown, right? The fear of the unknown is terrible. You are talking about people who have been trained to fear the legal system, fear lawyers, and they can be brought into the legal system in any number of ways. Sometimes it's because they provided proper care to an injured person. Sometimes it's because a patient was the victim of abuse in some setting, and now there's legal issues or criminal issues involved. And sometimes it's because one of their coworkers was involved in some adverse event. And so there's different ways that a person can be brought in, and there's different ways that has to be addressed, but you have to be prepared for it. When you get the letter or a subpoena, the last thing to do is to say, bury your head in the sand or to fear the unknown. And I think that with knowledge does come power. And there's a physician that actually came to my law school class last year who was one of your listeners and a fan of yours, and his name's Jeff Willis. And he talks about this for our law school class because hopefully some of our students will end up in administrative positions or, you know, risk management positions. So we want them to be able to talk to physicians, nurses, healthcare administrators about litigation because, you know, what is quote unquote malpractice? What does it mean to violate the standard of care? Because what people's mind is as the colloquial standard of care as a physician, it may be different than what the legal system defines it as. And of course, there's expert witness roles, there's other forensic roles that that physicians may be called upon to play, voluntarily or involuntarily. So we do talk to them about that. And then generally, either my wife or partner handles those components. The focus of my presentations are typically prevention of medical error, prevention of medical injury, and dealing with it in the aftermath. And so what I try to focus on are what are the contributing factors, the root cause factors that lead to adverse events and iatrogenic harm, starting with communication errors, which is the number one factor, coupled with diagnostic errors, usually from various heuristics, cognitive biases like anchoring bias, confirmation bias, availability bias, and how we have to be vigilant to avoid those and their impact. And then we talk about just the medical decision-making, and we use case studies, a closed case series, where we talk about different cases and what happened and where things went sideways. And then we talk about what happened afterwards, because in all of the case studies that happen, they either happen in an outside facility that didn't have a CRP program, someone's getting sued, and there's years of litigation, and it's terrible. It's terrible for the patient. It's terrible for the doctor. And the one thing that I know we agree on is that the litigation process itself, there are no winners in litigation. There's only who loses more emotionally, even physically, when you think about the effects of emotional trauma and sleepless nights and all the other impacts of trauma. So we talk about that and how to deal with that. And then usually I close with some degree of self-care. And there's another book I wanted to recommend. It is Greg Hammer, who is a pediatric anesthesiologist at Stanford. And I'll send you a copy. It is called Gain Without Pain.
We're going to have a Doctors in Litigation, the L Word book club, I think. All right. I haven't read either of these, so I'm going to read them. And I'll put links to these things in the show notes. And if they're, as we close out, if someone wants to get in touch with you or to have you come speak or teach at their institution, how would they do that?
Sure. Well, feel free to email me. I'm sure in your show notes, you can put my website or actually just put my email address. People are welcome to contact us. We do not charge ever And we don't accept honorariums either for speaking at medical schools or, you know, other institutions. If there is like mandatory compensation, we donate that. We ask that it be donated to the Mott Children's Hospital at the University of Michigan. So that's how you get in touch with me. And I'm happy to talk to essentially anyone live or by Zoom or any other way to help spread the message of, number one, that CRP programs are the answer to this problem. And one of the things that we know, no doctor goes into medicine to harm a patient. It's the opposite. You're there to help people. And just because someone's been sued, or even where it's a meritorious lawsuit, there was an adverse event, there was a mistake, and someone was hurt. When I was a police officer, I was sued. I was sued when someone died. Thankfully, there wasn't any mistake on my part or any adverse event on my part. But just because something happens doesn't make you a bad person. And internalizing that causes more harm. And that's actually, Dr. Hammer talks quite a bit about mindfulness, about physical and spiritual health in his book. And so I'm going to send you that as well.
I'm going to check both of those out. Thank you so much for your time, Chad. I'm sure we'll have other conversations at some point, but thanks for coming and talking to our listeners about your perspective and about CRP programs. And I'm sure we will stay in touch.
Well, thank you, Gita. And, you know, thank you both for having me on the podcast. And also thank you to your audience. Thank you to all those caring physicians and advanced practice providers, PAs, nurse practitioners, and nursing that are out there practicing and helping people and, you know, exemplifying excellence in care and making things better for our community. You are appreciated.
Thank you. Thanks again to Chad Engelhardt. I will leave his email in the show notes. And that's a wrap on season two of the Doctors and Litigation, the L Word podcast. Thank you, everybody, for listening and for your continued support and for sharing this podcast with anyone that you think needs it. I'll be back to talk to you again in just a few months.